Blog Talk Radio.
Well, the sound of that beautiful Eastern Airlines theme music tells you that we are once again coming to you live on the Eastern Airlines radio show. Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to be with you again, doing what we most enjoy doing, and that is talking about Eastern Airlines. We come to you live each Monday evening, as we have over the last, would you believe, 3.5 years. It's been fun talking about the company that we dedicated a great number of years to, and a company that gave us so much more in return. That is why we keep broadcasting the good news of Eastern. Your host for tonight's show, these are the fellows that are on the air, fellows and girls, I should say, Steve Thompson, Cecile Intagliato, Neil Holland, and, of course, me up here in Martha's Vineyard. How about saying hello to our listeners from each one of you? Steve, how are things up there in Roaring Gap, North Carolina?
Well, Jim, it's a cool, cloudy, overcast 72 degrees and a light rain that is just making the grass grow like mad. I see the raindrops outside my window right now as we're speaking. Beautiful. Come on up to see us up in Roaring Gap.
That's wonderful, Steve. Thank you. And Cecile, how are things in hot and humid Boca Raton?
Hot and humid, but it's been raining almost every day, so our grass is growing nice and green. Great time to fertilize it, and it's in the 90s, so it's hot and humid.
And so, Neil, how about you up there in Punta Gorda, Florida?
Well, you almost got it right. It's Punta Vedra. And, yes, we've had a little moisture in our backyard, too. But I'll always welcome rain. I love to see things green in this area of Florida. The further south we get, down toward where you guys are, West Palm Beach and Cecile, I guess it's green all the time there. But it gets quite chilly here in the winter. So we welcome actually the weather here is pretty hot and humid, so I can't say anything more, so I'll let it go at that. But everything is fine here in Ponte Vedra, and we're close to, actually halfway between Jacksonville, Florida, and St. Augustine, and we have a St. Augustine address here. So
Thank you, Neil.
Okay.
Well, and here I am, Jim Hart. I'm up here on the little island of Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, where today the weather has been partly cloudy, but I'll tell you, it's been only 67 to 72 degrees, which is much to my pleasure. And the people here are just fantastic. They're waiting for President Obama's visit. And Neil, let's start up that engine and get this show in the air.
Okay, why don't we do that? Let's see if we can get this engine started here.
That is wonderful. Just as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, you can call in to 213-816-1611. if you would like to be on the air with your host, once you hear our host, just press number 1 on your telephone dial pad. This will open your phone for live conversation. Don't forget, we have a toll-free number also. It's 877-572-1861. Let me repeat both of those numbers for you. And then, Neil, you can tell us about tonight's show. The first telephone number is 213-816-1611 and 877-572-1861. Please let us hear from you. Go ahead, Neil.
Thank you, Jim. I bet you guys listening to us can't recognize that theme music and from what TV show. Anyone want to make a guess at it? Host?
It was in
I don't
and out
have
on
a clue.
My phone, so I didn't hear it, Neil.
Well, at any rate, I'll identify it in just a minute. It really gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest tonight. He's my brother-in-law, Richard Green, and he and my sister, Claudia, have been married for 42 years, and they have 2 sons and 2 grandchildren, twins, boy and girl. I believe I got that right, but Rich, you'll probably correct me if I got the 42 years right or wrong, but that was the FBI theme music. And Efren Zimbalist Jr. was the star of that show back in the 60s. And I used to be dedicated to that program, a great TV show. But to be truthful, we haven't had much contact over the years, Rich, you and I and Claudia. But I've always been fascinated with your career as an FBI agent. I guess most people are more in awe of an FBI agent than an airline pilot. Well, at least I am. Rich has shared some of his thrilling adventures with me, and I hope to hear more about them tonight. One that I think you might like to hear is a Lockerbie, Scotland, Pan Am Flight 103, that went down December 21st, 1988. And Rich was one of the first investigators of that tragic bombing. Rich, thanks for agreeing to be with us on our radio show tonight, and can you fill us in on the rest of your bio for our listeners, and did I get everything correct?
Spot on, as the Brits say, Neil. And, yeah, that's a great theme music. I was inspired by that show with Efren Zimbalist Jr., whose father was a 4-star admiral and a great human being, but... Yeah, that's a show that got me interested in the Bureau, and then after I finished college and did my military, I applied for the Bureau and was accepted into the FBI Academy in May of 1969. But if you want a little bit of background as far as my own life, I'll be more willing to share that with you.
Yes, please. Please do so, Rich.
You know, really, I'm not sure exactly how long the show is. the show is, but I was born in Newark, New Jersey in 1943, and I grew up in the town of Union outside of about 15 miles west of Midtown, and went to Rutgers College, which is State University of New Jersey, and graduated with a BS degree in economics and a minor in accounting. And during the course of the 4 years, I was enrolled in Air Force ROTC. So upon graduation, I was commissioned to second lieutenant in the Air Force, and then proceeded to enter into the Air Force in November of 69. And I did 3.5 years. I wanted to be a pilot, but I didn't have the 20/20 vision. So I went into intelligence, Air Force Security Service, which is an intel service.
And the whole body.
And I,
excuse me, go ahead.
And then I, spent 3.5 years in the Air Force and separated as a captain. Spent a year in Vietnam and did intel gathering from an airborne platform. We had about 50 DC-3, C-47s, and we conducted intercepts of voice and Morse. And we did a lot of good work as far as gathering intel, and live intel was encrypted down from the aircraft to 7th Air Force headquarters in Saigon. And if it was, real-time enemy movement or something, 7th Air Force would send up 52s to do carpet bombing, or they would use tactical aircraft, you know, to do strafing and stuff as far as enemy movements. But it was a great little organization over there. We reportedly provided over 90% of the actual intel during the period of time that we were flying those 50 aircraft throughout South Vietnam. Then I left and joined the FBI. I was accepted. I left out of San Antonio, Texas. I was at Kelly Air Force Base when I came back from Vietnam, which is, at that time, the headquarters of United States Air Force Security Service. And I took a week off and entered into the FBI and on May 12th of 1969. And then about 28 years later, I separated, or retired, actually, from the FBI. The FBI was very interesting, undercover work for a couple of years, supervised for many, many years, and a lot of it was in espionage and international terrorism. The undercover work was against the radicals back in the early 70s. Your listeners might remember there was a group called the Weathermen who were anarchists. They were bombers. They wanted to overthrow the government, and we were pretty well targeted against them out of Chicago, which is where they were located. So I did that for about 2 years and did a lot of work throughout the country in different field divisions. The first was Jacksonville, near where you live now, Neil. And I was chasing fugitives back then. And then Chicago for about 5 years, did the 2 years of undercover work against the New Left, the radicals, the bombers, the killers. Headquarters, where I supervised a lot of different espionage of Eastern Bloc countries here in the U.S. As your listeners might know, the FBI does internal security. We have a lot of criminal responsibilities, but on the internal security side, we do a lot of espionage work, and now a lot of international terrorism work. But I think the most rewarding of all the jobs I had was the 3-year stint as the assistant legal attaché at the American Embassy in London, where I was responsible for liaison with MI5, which is the FBI's criminal equivalent over there as far as internal security. It's not criminal. And all the Scandinavian countries and Finland. So I was on the road a lot, and I worked with those countries a lot as far as providing assistance from the FBI in areas that they needed training or help, and then also working international terrorism cases and espionage cases with the United Kingdom and Scandinavia plus Finland. So it was really quite exciting and quite rewarding. But that's enough for me.
Well,
Rich, this is Steve Thompson. Based upon your background and your experience, to me, the greatest threat to our nation right now and our way of life is these radical Muslims and the jihadists. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. It is such a difficult group to work against. You know, because you can only get so much intel. Thank God for all the great intelligence that we're getting through the National Security Agency. But on the ground, it's very difficult, you know, to get intel, to get into the cells, to get close to the cells. I know the Bureau, you know, I'm far removed from the FBI, but I know the Bureau, from what I understand, is doing a great job in this country as far as the cells that are over here, which... are part of this international terrorism grouping, you know, albeit it could be, you know, a group out of Afghanistan, it could be Al-Qaeda, it could be factions from the Taliban, but it's very difficult. But I understand that the Bureau, you know, with their sophistication as far as undercover work and you know, human intelligence on the ground is doing a great job, but it represents by far the greatest threat that this country has ever experienced, and it's—I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And the Bureau is working really diligently, very diligently, and I know the National Security Agency is doing a great job, and we're doing a lot of work, you know, with our friendly countries, especially the UK.
You know,
thank
Rich,
you,
Rich. You've told me about a little bit about Lockerbie and how that how you happened upon being there at the time when the airplane went down over Lockerbie. I think you were in the lead as far as the investigators in that accident, or not accident. I keep wanting to call air tragedies accidents, air criminal tragedies, and like the one that. A Malaysian Flight 17 just a few days ago. And in comparison, I guess that was an aerial bomb shot up to that airplane as opposed to a bomb planted on Pan Am Flight 103. Can you tell us a little bit about how you actually got involved in the Lockerbie incident?
Absolutely. You know, that was a very... transforming investigation as far as the legal attaché in London. The legal attaché in London had four agents, and we had diplomatic status. We were detailed to the State Department. We had a nice office in the embassy. We had great relations with the ambassadors when I was there, and we had a group of four guys that were really dedicated FBI agents, and they work closely with the State Department and also NSA, well, mostly the CIA, but my particular responsibility, we each had our own responsibilities. I was in charge as far as the FBI, their representative at the American Embassy in the UK, and for me it also expanded to Scandinavia plus Finland. I was with MI5, not so much 6. You know, that's MI5, as I said, military intelligence. It's an old acronym, but they're a civilian government group that's responsible for intelligence gathering as far as defense of the nation when it comes to internal security, which the FBI does here. Are the big, obvious responsibility are the criminal investigations. But I also had international terrorism, which is a criminal investigation. It morphs into criminal investigations with MI5. The Scotland Yard's anti-terrorism branch, if your listeners are not aware of it, MI5 Scotland Yard is the equivalent to the NYPD. It's a police force for London. But within that, they have the anti-terrorist branch, and they have international responsibility in the UK for international terrorism. So I worked espionage cases with MI5. I worked international terrorism cases with Scotland Yard and their anti-terrorism branch. But I did all criminal and espionage, internal security in Scandinavia and Finland, which sounds a little strange, but there was a lot going on in Scandinavia, and there still is when it comes to international terrorism. So it was really exciting. And with the Pan Am 103, we had a lot of work. We were constantly busy prior to Pan Am 103. When Pan Am 103 went down, it turned the whole office around. I mean, we were just as busy as we possibly could be 24/7 because it was just a major investigation as far as coordinating it with the European countries. Everybody had some type of work involved. When I say everybody, I'm speaking of all these different countries, Germany, Holland, Scandinavia, the Finns. Everybody had little bits and pieces of investigation into that tragedy. And the Brits were great. The Scottish police were great. I was put in charge of coordinating that investigation for the FBI abroad, which obviously, you know, was the main thrust of the investigation due to the fact that it landed it was blown up over Lockerbie, Scotland. And it continued for the last 18 months of my three-year tour, and it was just a intense, very rewarding investigation to see how all these different law enforcement organizations were working so hard in attempting to resolve this very difficult investigation. The reward was we did eventually identify the people that were responsible for the bombing, but it took years, Neil. When I left after 18 months of nonstop working, trying to piece together as much as we could, we had not identified the bombers. You know, that came later, but it was just it was an incredible investigation, and I have are off to the Brits and especially the Scottish police, which did a magnificent job during the course of that investigation.
You told me an interesting incident that happened while you were over there with one of, I think you said it was a Pan American captain that came into your office one day. Can you, do you remember that that little story you told me?
That was quite an unusual event. It was actually a telephone call. And I, as a legal attaché, people really didn't realize that, this is the FBI, that we weren't undercover like the CIA is at these embassies. They have diplomatic positions. They could be some type of attaché in the American Services Offices. We were the legal attachés. We were the FBI. So we weren't like undercover or, using a diplomatic cover. But so we didn't deal too much with the public, even though we were known to be, the FBI in the American embassy. So I didn't take too many phone calls. However, one day the secretary said to me, and I was in the office, it was a phone call, and she said that there was a Pan-American captain that wanted to talk to me. And, the reason I took it was I figured, this might be something that this individual is aware of because he's a Pan Am employee. I didn't recognize his name, so I picked up the phone, and I'm talking to this captain. I won't give his name. I still remember his name. And he was terribly upset because he was a senior 747 Pan Am captain, and his wife was a flight attendant aboard that aircraft, Pan 103, and he was very upset with the FBI, and I guess just everyone, but the FBI had to leave as far as, you know, an American company. The fact that it's taken so long to identify, you know, the people, the parties responsible for the bomb that was placed upon that aircraft. And it's funny, Neil, that was the first time I ever had to deal with a family member of one of the victims. And it just coincidentally, you know, he was a Pan Am captain and his wife was a flight attendant. And he was totally upset, you know, that we were, like, basically dragging our feet or not getting the answer to the persons or the individuals that had blown the aircraft up. And, you know, I tried to explain to him that, you know, we were working night and day and we had all these agencies, all these different countries, and everybody was working as hard as they could. But and I understood the fact that, hey, this guy is he just lost his wife. You know, and I felt really bad for him, but nothing I could say would console him. So it was just one of those things that I chalk up to, hey, I probably might be in the same position if I was that captain, you know, trying to, you know, get answers.
Well,
but I got to say a couple, if you want a couple words about that investigation, I'll be more than happy.
Please do.
When I... When I first started that and I was put in charge of it, the most interesting thing when I look back was when we received word from Frankfurt, from the police. Actually, it came through our legal attaché in Bonn, but they had identified two Palestinians that transited Frankfurt prior to that plane departing to London. And these were a couple of Palestinians, young guys, in their 20s, if I recall. And they were going up to Helsinki. And then I called, the Finns called me in Helsinki, the chief of their internal security group, a great guy. And the Finns are really tremendous people and tough people. And he said, hey, we think we got him. And I'm thinking, this is great. This is like the second day after the plane went down, because I believe they arrived in Helsinki, if not that night, the morning after the tragedy. And just because the Finns are so tight when it comes to internal security, they grabbed these guys coming into the country at the airport. And they had him in Helsinki at the security service, the Finnish security service. So I flew up there. That, you know, I said that I was initially up to Lockerbie, but I did get a little delayed because I had to jump on a plane to go up to Helsinki to work with the Finns on these two people that I personally thought, and from talking to them, were probably the people that were in charge of placing the bomb aboard aircraft. That was before we found out that it didn't get placed on the aircraft in Frankfurt. It was in Malta. So I flew up there, and we had another agent that went up to Lockerbie with the ambassadors that next day after the plane was blown up. And the downside was that they had all the earmarks of people that would have been responsible, because they had a little notebook and they had it in Farsi, and they had little diagrams that looked like little circuits and stuff. But the Finns did such a great job and they eliminated them. But I'm thinking, hey, I'm going to come back from Helsinki with these two guys in tow. You know, forget this case is off. But the Finns, you know, I say to the Finns, I say, all right, where's the clerk of the hotel that checked him in? He's in the back. Everybody was in the back. You know, they went out and they just grabbed everyone in Helsinki that had any contact whatsoever with these two guys out of Palestine, you know. So it was really an eye-opening experience for me as far as how a country, I'm glad we're not that way, but, you know, internal security can be real tight, and they should that with that. But back to the Lockerbie, that Dumfries Constabulary, you know, one of the smallest of the eight in Scotland, did a marvelous job. And at the height of the investigation, there were over 3,500 officers, police officers, you know, from Scotland, England, and then total there were probably 1,500, because, 5,000, another 1,500. So they had civilians and they had military, you know, when they were looking for evidence, which when you look at the scope of the crime scene, which we didn't know was a crime, you know, that came later, but it was about 800 square miles. I mean, parts of it were found up in the North Sea shore, which is 90 miles, you know, west over the plane, you know, the plane was blown down, blown up and crashed. So it was just an unbelievable investigation, the fact that over an 800 square mile crime scene, they were able to come up with the little bits and pieces of information that led to the apprehension, identification and apprehension of the Libyan intelligence officers.
Rich, in your mind, in your mind's eye, can you see what's happening over in the Ukraine now with the you know, shooting down of the Malaysian airplane? And that you don't have the resources like the FBI involved. You just have the Russian rebels that are actually doing everything, I guess. Have you been keeping up with that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in the morning I generally put on Fox News, which really does a great job 24/7 as far as covering defense. And, you know, I'm quite sure, you know, this is a totally different investigation. We had no clue what happened. You know, the only clue we had initially was some real brilliant FAA guy who was in Germany at the time. And my boss was talking to him that night. The plane went down. He said, hey, his name is Darrell Mills. He said, hey, Darrell, there's no way in the world that this thing came apart. This thing was refitted not that long ago. They were refitting these 747s, making them real strong, so if they needed to, they could use them as cargo aircraft in type, you know, in case of a military emergency. He said, there's no way in the world this thing just broke up for no reason. You know, he was convinced it was an act of terrorism, but it took us a long time to figure it out. Well, we figured it out Christmas Eve, but that's 3 days. This thing we knew right off, you know, from the get-go that it was an act of war, and my sense is, Neil, with all this high-tech stuff with the NSA and GCHQ, a great counterpart in the UK of the NSA, they're as good, if not better, than the NSA. They know exactly what happened, and all the satellites and everything going on. They could probably tell you right now, yeah, that thing was, that SA-11 or whatever it was, you know, sent up at, from this location at this time, you know. So we know exactly that it was the, you know, the separatists, the pro-Russian separatists that launched that thing. The only way we can really find out how how involved were the Russians would be getting information as far as, you know, intel conversations or maybe some, you know, some people that we have human intelligence, but, you know, it was definitely a missile that was sent by those Ukrainian nationals.
Yeah, Rich, if I can break in here, we've got our board lit up. This is one of the most popular shows we've had since we announced that we had an FBI agent that would be with us tonight, and we do have several callers, so. Folks, if you want to ask Rich a question, our host, we have three or four of our hosts on air too, please do so. And if you're calling in, if you want to say something, just hit number one on your keypad and just charge right in and ask Rich any question that you may have been wondering about, and he'd be happy to answer. But, Rich, this is extremely interesting. It is to me. I've been watching too much of the TV 24 with Kiefer Sutherland, and I can't visualize you being like Kiefer Sutherland. But
I wish I had his money.
yeah, there you go. And looks, I might add.
yeah,
but, I hate to insult our guest, but he's my brother-in-law, folks. But any questions from our audience, our host?
Well, Neil, this is Bob Furman. Am I in the queue?
You are in the queue. Hey, Bob, good to hear from you.
Good and to hear from you, Neil.
Go ahead and ask
Richard,
your question.
Very interesting. I was a pilot with Eastern Airlines, and I finished my career 15 years with Airborne Express. And my wife, Brenda, was with a major airline, and she was very involved with health, safety, and security and knew a lot of the nuances that you were talking about. But one of the big questions I have, you know, I guess there's Pollyanna in all of us. We raise our kids, go to the PTA meetings, sporting events, go to church, and we always expect the common good from everybody. But from where you've been and from what we know as we get older, we really are mired in a lot of corruption everywhere. And how did you maintain that sense of common good to your neighbors and everybody else, knowing what you were deeply involved with all the time? That's my question.
Great question. Great question.
Well, it's funny. I have always had this sense of right and wrong. I'm not a saint, but I can't do anything that's not good for humanity as far as, helping mankind and doing right and wrong. And so the job of the Bureau seemed to be a perfect fit. It just seemed that it's a smaller organization. They really vet these people that work for them, and they're involved in some of the most heinous crimes in this country or internationally. And so it was always very easy for me to stay focused on doing good for, mankind, society. And I never really thought of it any other way. And one thing I liked about the Bureau is the fact that, it's very rare, and we've had our, a couple, very rarely that agents go wrong. They just seem to do a good job vetting FBI agents before they put them into the academy. And it's a nice feeling of, giving back, doing the right thing and putting the bad guys in the slammer. I didn't always do it in international terrorism or espionage, which doesn't get any type of press, because generally speaking, unless it's a person in this country who doesn't have diplomatic immunity, you're not going to read about it. And it happens all the time where we grab guys, and I used to do it myself personally when I was working these cases, we grab guys that are recruiting our citizens to be spies, and it works, but they have diplomatic immunity, so it doesn't go to the press. They just get kicked out of the country, persona non grata. So to me, it was always like, hey, this is the right thing to do.
Can I add one thing to that? Do you find that most of the people that you were trying to intercept, and then once you did you find that they were people that weren't like what you said? They were very void of conscience?
Yeah, that seems to be, I think it's mostly, it's funny. I've tried to analyze these different people, just across the spectrum, and it seems like they don't have any conscience whatsoever. They probably know right or wrong, but they don't care. And a lot of it is so motivated by greed. But now when you get this work, I was involved in, as far as international terrorism, this is all, it's scary because it's all driven by their beliefs as far as the religion. And that's what's really the scary part of it, and it makes it much more difficult and difficult to really, you can't really talk to these people. You could sit down and try to explain how, you know, taking a human life is a mortal sin, taking a human life is against the rule of God, but, you know, not with their God. So it makes it a very difficult target as far as dealing with them.
Thank you for your answer, sir. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You know, Rich, I shouldn't tell this, but you were before undercover, and when I first checked out as captain, one of the first trips, folks, that I took was a layover in Chicago, and at that time, my little sister was working for United Airlines and married to Rich, and she was off flying somewhere, and I called, and Rich answered the phone, said, well, Claudia's on a trip somewhere, but... how about coming on over and we'll do the town? And he showed me Old Town, and he had an old English taxi cab that was the talk of the town and fun to drive in. And we went to an air show on the lake there, Lake Michigan, and were sprayed by a Harrier jet aircraft. And I remember all those days. But my little sister sent me a picture one day, and she said, do you recognize anyone in this picture? And it was a picture that was on the front page of the Miami Herald, and it was spread from all the way across the width of the front page, and a panoramic picture someone had taken. And I looked and looked and see if I could recognize anyone, but she had to tell me in the letter that look at the guy in the center of the picture with the headband and the long hair. And sure enough, there was my brother-in-law, Richard Green. FBI.
That was, you know, they were chasing us. That was the summer of 72, and I was working undercover against the Weathermen underground out of Chicago, the bombers.
Okay.
And Bernie Dean was one of the top tenors. She's married today to Bill Ayers, but she was one of the bombers, and we were down there probably helping a lot as far as identifying actions at the these domestic terrorists we're going to take against the people at the conventions, but also we're trying to get leads on, you know, where these top 10 weathermen underground people were. And we were doing a demonstration in front of Fontainebleau, and the cops came in and chased us away. And it just so happened I was in the, you know, trying to get the hell out of there. Can you say that on the radio? Try to get the heck out of there. And so I didn't want to get hit in the head with one of those batons. But real interesting, the guy that I just spoke to, the Eastern guy, I'll tell you, I used to, just as a courtesy, when I flew and was carrying a weapon, I'd always go to the cockpit because I like airplanes. I used to fly myself. And I introduced myself to the crew and say, hey, I'm Richard Green. And I'd be in a suit, obviously, because that'd be on official business. And I forget what airline it was. And this captain, who was obviously a senior captain because he had gray hair, said, oh, well, welcome aboard. And here, happy to have you, but I'm going to have your bullets. I said, what? He said, well, I don't allow people to fly in this aircraft with a loaded weapon. I said, well, I'm an FBI agent, and I'm required to carry this weapon on official business. And he said, well, no, not on my airplane. Well, to make a long story short, we did take off with a short delay with me with the bullets and the weapon.
Well, it wasn't an Eastern pilot for sure.
No, it wasn't. It was probably United.
Yeah.
This is Jim Hart on the island of Martha's Vineyard. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes, I can.
Rich, you know, it's, as you know, the president comes here just about every year, and those of us who know about this leave the island as quickly as we can because it leaves us with such a really unfortunate hubbub. Everything is just so messed up. But anyway, I'm kind of asking you, of course, maybe you're FBI, and I'm thinking about Secret Service. But before the president gets here, there's a whole bunch of guys in khaki shorts and white shirts that start circulating all over the island, and we know who they are. But the thing is that do you get involved in the president's visit to our beautiful island?
Yeah, that would be covered, I assume, by Boston, our Boston office. What they do is they come in, we have conferences with the Secret Service, and we share information regarding anyone that might be in that area that we are concerned about, and we pass it on to the Secret Service. We don't really get involved as far as protection detail. We provide intel to them, and they work closely with the local PDs and probably the state police or any sheriff's department as far as, you know, the overall protection. The Bureau mostly gets involved with sharing information with the Secret Service because they're the point on it, and they're the protection detail. That's a great outfit. I really have a lot of respect for our Secret Service and really dedicated jobs, but dedicated individuals. But they're the guys on the ground. Now, if there's a concern, we'll send agents out, you know, to assist. But normally speaking, all the stuff on the ground is handled by the Secret Service, the local PD, state, and the other law enforcement agencies.
Thank you very much, Rich. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Who's got another question? Neil?
Cecile,
I have a question. Do you know, or I read the book of Richard Hansen, I believe I have his name correctly, the former FBI agent that spied for Russia. Do you know whatever happened to his family? Was his wife prosecuted, or was she innocent, or his book was fascinating?
As far as I know, is it Cecile?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I don't believe there was any prosecution of her. He actually saved his life because that's, treason is punishable by death and under federal law, and he could have been executed. But apparently, and I was not involved in the investigation, but apparently he was very cooperative and gave all the information he could to save his life, which it did do. But I don't believe any kind of prosecution went past Hansen and his family, which apparently was a great family, and he just happened to be from talking to friends of mine who knew Hansen, because we're contemporaries, Hansen and I. He was very bright. He was a very good espionage agent that somehow went south, and I think it was for money.
Right. Yeah, his book was that it was for money, and I think he also had a very devout Catholic, too, but he was an extreme Catholic, and he, it's hard to describe, he really wasn't a Catholic, but his biography was rather interesting and fascinating. I forget what they do, where they worship certain things. It's not in the Catholic religion, but I forget what the word is. Do you recall what religion he was?
He was Catholic.
There was something that he did that was different than the normal. I forget what it was. Anyway, his book was, and he, what he did is he spied for Russia, correct, and gave Russian secrets of the U.S. Correct.
Oh yeah, he. As far as I know, I didn't read his book. I wouldn't read his book. I wouldn't, person like that. As far as I'm concerned, I would, I'm just happy he was identified as a double agent and found guilty and put in jail for life. But no, he was
right.
a devout Catholic. Another thing that I heard through the grapevine was he was very unhappy with with the fact that he thought he was the brightest espionage agent, which is a big portion of the FBI. There's an awful lot of agents that are detailed to espionage work in this country, because there's a lot of espionage activity that the American public is not aware of, but it's constant. And he was very upset with the fact that he was not being promoted higher than his current position when he was at FBI headquarters. So he was upset also with the FBI. So it was a combination of him not feeling that he was duly recognized by the FBI as far as his expertise and his capabilities, and not receiving the promotions he felt that he was, he had earned.
That's mentioned in the book a lot, and I'm so glad you all did such great work in investigating him and finally catching him. It's really quite an interesting book.
That thing went on for years, apparently. I was not involved in it, as I said, but we knew there was someone, but we just couldn't figure out who it was.
Yeah. Okay, thank you for your feedback on that.
Rich, you serve under J. Edgar Hoover?
I was going to ask the same question, Jim. You beat me to it.
He was the director. I went to the FBI Academy in May of 69. He was the director. We met him when we graduated. He was then at the Department of Justice. That was before they built that monstrosity down there, which I spent 5 years at, that FBI building. He was in the Department of Justice. He had a magnificent office. So when we graduated from the academy, we went up to his office and met him individually. But I didn't know much about the guy because the first year I was chasing fugitives in Jacksonville when we did federal fugitives. We don't do them anymore. And then I went to Chicago and I was undercover for a couple of years, and he died when I was undercover, and he didn't know that we were undercover. They did it without informing him in Chicago, because he didn't think that his FBI agent should be in that kind of position. So I got the word when I was undercover on the street. Hey, an interesting story, Neil. You want me to tell you one about when I was on the street? About airplanes?
Yes, go, please.
I got two of them that were sort of cool. One day, I had a way to contact the office. I had a beeper that couldn't be traced back to anything except, my own little personal private beeper. But if they needed to be in touch with me, they beat me. So I'd go to a payphone and call, and I'd say, hey, Rich, we have a demand. I think it was $1 million, and they were going to blow up a United Airlines flight. And I said, oh, okay, what do you want me to do? He said, we want you to cover the drop, okay? Because I was, I had a beard and I had long hair. And so I could, wherever the drop was, I could cover it without a problem, because there were a lot of freaky people back then. And then I thought, hold it, that's Claudia. Your sister's flight. I said,
oh,
my God. So I immediately, when I got off the phone with the Chicago office, I called Claudia's residence to say call in sick, but she had left for the flight. The good news was, they didn't put a bomb aboard the aircraft, and we apprehended the people that made the demand. But and another one was, we had a Delta flight that was going to be blown up, so there was a drop. And I think it was Oakhurst, which is a really upscale neighborhood west of Chicago. And so they said, all right, guys, you get out there. There's a field near where the drop is going to be made. The agents will have undercover agents. Well, agents, not undercover, but agents wearing a Delta uniform and a Delta van, and they're going to make the drop. And it's going to be near this tree in this park. And there's no way for any agent cars, any surveillance, so we want you to go out there with your other freaky friend, undercover agent, play football or whatever, and watch the bag, which had $1 million in it or whatever. And so we're, you know, playing football. Nothing ever happened, you know. So they make the drop. We watched the attaché case with the $1 million or whatever was in it, and it was never picked up. And I go, well, that's strange. So,
Rich, this is Jim Hart again. Did you have anything to do or helpful with the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa?
Oh, no, no. A friend of mine, when I was a supervisor in Newark, was in charge of that investigation. And I don't know how many times he and the agents would have to go out to do a dig in some place around Giant Stadium trying to find his body. But, that was the case. Now, I still believe he's at Giant Stadium under the goalpost someplace.
Yeah.
Well, before we run out of time, Rich, and host and audience, I'd like to tell you that Rich has got a book that's coming out of his life with the FBI. I'm just kidding, Rich, but it would be a great idea if you could write a book, and I think it would sell, because the information and the stories you've shared with us tonight have been great. So I would buy one in a second.
It was an interesting career.
Yeah, it was. Airline flying is boring, except we, you know, get that 1% of stark terror every once in a while. But I might add, if you ever get down to Cape Canaveral or Melbourne area, Rich and Claudia, my sister, and they live there in O'Galley, and we used to fly into Titusville with Eastern and Melbourne, of course. They're right halfway between each other, the O'Galley, right there close to Patrick's Air Force Base. And they have a wonderful antique shop right there in O'Galley downtown. And I visited with them last week, about a week ago, or has it been 2 weeks now, Rich?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. And the stuff that they have in there is just outstanding. And Rich restores now in his retirement. He restores everything, but he primarily restores old grandfather clocks, mantle clocks, or any types of clocks that that you would want to really be pride and put in your decorations. And plenty of those in there. And Rich has done a beautiful job of restoration. I think anything your hands touch, it's just meticulously done. And there's still a compass from a Sherman tank that was sitting on one of the shelves. And I hope I can save up enough money, Rich, to come back and have lunch with you and talk you down on the price of that. But I'd certainly
like to have it. You know, we negotiate.
You negotiate. All right. But
Neil?
Rich, yeah.
Yeah, Charlie's mother left him an antique clock, so I'll have to send a grandfather clock. I'll have to send you all pictures. But it got valued at from $3,000 to $30,000. What a vast difference.
Wow.
But it's got eight chimes or something. I don't know, but I'll email it to you.
Okay, and I'll get it to Rich, and maybe Rich can put some history to it.
Cool.
Absolutely.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Those clocks are fantastic, those old grandfathers.
Well, with just a few minutes left, Rich, tell us about what you're doing there at the shop. And I didn't give you a good enough pitch there for what you and Claudia have. I think she's got one room of her stuff, and she showed me a picture of our dad on the railroad, because he was a railroadman, station master there in Goldsboro, North Carolina, and she showed me that picture. She wouldn't sell me for that for anything in the world, but at any rate, tell us about what you're doing there.
Well, Neil, we're in this area of Melbourne, Florida. We used to live in Melbourne Beach. We moved over here. It's called O'Galley, which in the I think it's French Indians is rocky waters, because we're right on the intercoastal here, which is called the Indian River. And it's a town of Melbourne on the north side of it. It's an old historic district. Yep. And the shop has a lot of antiques that I've restored over the years that we now have no room for, and we're more than happy to part with them for the right price. Claudia, as you know, is an artist and an interior designer, and she has all this beautiful stuff that she has collected over the years in Mies, different art pieces, china, furniture that she restores with the process out of England using a chalk, I think it's called chalk paint, which is beautiful stuff. And so basically the shop has a little over two rooms, and mostly my stuff with, you know, all the clocks and, like, you know, you name it, we have it, German tank compasses and
Chris, I think we are at the end of our program.
Oh, great. Well, it was great talking to you all.
Well, before we leave, Jim, Rich, rather, I will, anyone wanting information about how to get in touch with Rich Green, Richard Green, and talk to Claudia, my sister, about some of the products that they have in their shop in O'Galley, if you live in that area, please give me an email. Send the radio show, ealradioshow.com, and you'll see contact us, and I'll certainly get your request down to Rich and Claudia, and they'll be happy to show you and welcome you into their beautiful store there. Rich, again, I appreciate you being with us tonight, and wonderful information that you gave. Very interesting, and thanks a lot. I appreciate it. And we're about out of time as Jim was about to wrap up the show. But I'm going to put some music in there. And Jim Hart, are you
I'm here.
Okay,
yep.
Start that all over again. I had to cut you
all
short.
All right. I'm glad that we could get together tonight and talk about our airline days and events that, like one of you had for years and years ago. I am right now thanking everyone, hundreds of our visitors and listeners around the world. And we hope you that you can do it again next Monday at the same time, same station, and same place on your internet dial. Our significant bumper music tells me now, here it comes, that we are about out of time for this week's show. Tell your friends about this show. More importantly, please get to know the radio show that we have had every year, for 3.5 years. We are proud of the fact that this show is the only airline company radio show of its kind. It's part of the way that we are keeping in the memory of Eastern Airlines alive. We are very much the radio of Eastern Airlines. Well, that's it for folks. That's it for tonight. And from all of us, and from your host, we ask you and we say to you, good night, Eastern Airlines.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern Airlines.